Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hello. I'd like to welcome you to this afternoon's session, which is entitled Russia, Europe, NATO, and the Near Abroad. That's a pretty large area. My name is Jan Kalitsky. I am counselor for international strategy at the Chevron Corporation. And the format for this afternoon's session will be a short presentation by each of our speakers, followed by questions from you, the audience. And as in previous sessions, if you could please write out the questions on the cards that have been left on your seat, hand them to a member of the staff, indicate to which speaker your question is addressed, and of course, could I remind everyone to turn off their cell phones and beepers and the like for this session. Just this week in London, President Obama and President Medvedev seemed to move from reset to rebuild in relations between our two countries. Yet the issues facing the new administration in Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia, as well as in terms of NATO, on which there is another summit, are daunting. Control of energy supplies for Europe, pressuring Iran not to acquire nuclear weapons, negotiating arms reductions, and addressing missile defense, resolving both long-standing and recent conflicts in the post-Soviet space, proposed NATO membership for new countries to the east, and overcoming a radical Islamist threat from Afghanistan and Pakistan, just to name a few of the issues that we have to think about this afternoon. We're very pleased to welcome three experts to this session who will discuss the range of issues that the administration is confronting in its relations with the countries in this part of this world. And our first speaker today is Pavel Podvig, who is Acting Associate Director for Research at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University. Then our second panelist is an old friend of mine, Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, who is visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution's Center on the United States and Europe, and who served as ambassador to Ukraine from 1998 to 2000, and previously as special assistant to the President and National Security Council Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia. And then our third speaker is Jim Goldgeier, Senior Fellow for Transatlantic Relations at the Council on Foreign Relations, Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at George Washington University, and co-author of America Between the Wars, from 11-9 to 9-11. So that's quite a distinguished panel, and I look forward very much to what they have to say. And without further ado, let me ask Pavel to get us going, and then we'll go on to Stephen and Jim.
Pavel. Yep, thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here today and speak to this audience, and I would like to thank you for coming and for your interest in things Russian and NATO and European, I guess. And I'll talk mostly about missile defense and the current controversy around missile defense in Russia. And I think I've been studying missile defense for quite some time, and it's a very interesting, fascinating subject, especially if you look at the U.S.-Russian and U.S.-Soviet relations. It sort of keeps popping up every time, and I'm afraid it will be around for some time with us again. In many ways, the issues of missile defense sort of concentrate a lot of issues in the relationships between the United States and Russia, or it was the Soviet Union. And missile defense problems are a very good illustration of issues that that we have in our relationships. But at the same time, if you look closer at what are the problems, what are the disagreements, what are the technical or political issues of missile defense, you can see actually potential solutions to those problems. And the current dispute and the current controversy is certainly not an exception. Very briefly, at the center of the dispute is the decision that the United States made to deploy elements of missile defense system in Eastern Europe. There are radar in Czech Republic and 10 interceptors in Poland. And it's part of a larger program Part of it have been deployed already in Alaska. And the idea is to protect the United States, presumably from a missile threat from Iran. And that was done very much as part of that kind of expansion of the program, of the larger program. But for Russia, this particular deployment in Eastern Europe became the ultimate unfriendly act. I was thinking if the United States administration tried on purpose to find a place for this deployment, that would have been more problematic from the kind of a point of view of the passions that would incite in Russia. I thought that would have been, well, maybe they could have put it in Ukraine, or
Eastern Ukraine.
Yeah, that would have clinched it. But still, there. Again, if you look at this particular decision, a lot of things sort of were focused there. It was Poland. It was a former kind of Warsaw Pact country. It was a former ally. This proverbial sphere of influence and all this, and it's all linked to the issue of NATO expansion. And that, you could see how it quickly generates the passions. Russia insists, of course, that this missile defense system is not directed against Iran. The official line is that there is no threat from Iran, missile threat, which actually Russia has a point. But then the Russian officials and experts, they go and make the point that the system is actually directed against Russia. There is no other explanation, they say. And they say this is just a foothold and the United States is moving its strategic defense toward our borders. And some even claim that this is an attempt from the United States to actually gain the first strike advantage capability people compare this deployment to deployment of Pershing 2 missiles back in the 80s, for those of you who remember that. So that you can see that there is, as I said, the passions are very high. And none of that, of course, is true. I think the technical reality of missile defense in general, and this system in particular, is that this system will not be able to deny or to counter any kind of threat, whether it's the Iranian threat that may materialize at some point. And certainly this missile defense system cannot do anything against to deny or to threaten Russia's strategic forces. So in a way, the way I see it, it's this entire controversy, it's an artificial controversy around a very much useless system. But the problem is that the controversy is very real, even though we may not even see those interceptors and radars deployed. We see right now we are paying the price in terms of the relations. We are paying the price in terms of the kind of political costs that both countries have to pay to resolve this crisis. And again, as you can imagine, there are people in Russia, as well as there are people in the United States, who are benefiting from this controversy. There are certain elements in the military, in the military industry, politicians of all kind of stripes, and there are people who thrive on this kind of a chance to be anti-American and chance to be strong. And effectively, this whole issue is the only effect, the only real effect that it probably has and will have. It is just poisoning U.S.-Russian relations. Another problem is that it's not easy to resolve things missile defense related. And again, we've seen that. The United States tried to sort of brief Russia and to point out that those interceptors will not pose any threat to the Russian strategic forces, which is, again, it's a perfectly valid point, but that's exactly the problem, because if you think about this argument, then you realize that what's going on actually is the United States is trying to convince Russia that it is perfectly normal for Russia and the United States to be pointing tens of or hundreds of and thousands of nuclear warheads at each other, and this is the kind of the foundation of our relationship, and this is how it should be. And that's as I said, this is exactly the problem with missile defense, because it sort of it locks both countries in this kind of a Cold War mentality and confrontation, and that's certainly not healthy for our relationship. And so the solution should actually be somewhere in a different direction. It's not about convincing Russia that that missile defense system is not technically capable. They know that. It's not the issue. The solution should really be in building sort of institutions and mechanisms that would allow Russia and the United States to talk about these issues, to maintain constant dialogue. And that's something that's been lost in the last 8 years. And this is something that both countries would have to repair to reconstitute these mechanisms that would allow their politicians to talk about missile threats, their military to talk about this, and eventually to have people on both sides to work closely together. And there are promising signs. As you know, there was a Russian proposal that was made almost 2 years ago now that was to use Russian radars to monitor developments in the missile developments in places like Iran or in the Middle East. This is the radar in Azerbaijan, and this offer is still on the table. And there was some preliminary contact. The U.S. military went there and took a look, and the Russians were very proud that their radar is good for something. They were very happy, but then it sort of didn't take off. But there is a chance that the new administration will revive this effort. And as again, there are good signs. The London meeting between the presidents and the joint statement that was produced these efforts indicate that there is a serious intent to move the relationships forward, to build build the institutions of arms control and disarmament. And I'm sure once the United States takes the Russia's offer to use its radars and sends its military there, then they will eventually find a way of figuring out whether there is a threat from Iran, and if there is a threat, they will find ways of dealing with that. And the issue of missile defense, which right now appears to be very controversial, it eventually would just fade away. And that's the way to deal with most of the issues in our relations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pavel. And our next speaker is Steve Pfeiffer.
Well, thanks very much, John. As a native of the Bay Area, I'm always happy to get back here. What I'm going to talk about is U.S. relations with Ukraine and Georgia and how you manage that in the context of resetting relations with Russia. Certainly we saw on Wednesday that President Obama and President Medvedev agreed that there needs to be a new tenor, a new substance to the U.S.-Russia relationship, and that's worth doing. At the end of 2008, at the end of the second Bush term, U.S.-Russia relations had fallen to their lowest point since the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. And we saw just how thin that relationship was last August, when there's no evidence that any concern about damaging relations with Washington constrained Russian decision-making at all with regards to the actions they took in Georgia. So it's worth doing. It's worth trying to turn this relationship around. And it seems that on Wednesday that there's a pretty good basis laid. These two presidents have decided to focus on finding a replacement for the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. That will be good for arms control. It'll also be good for the broader relationship, because historically when you've had an active, robust dialogue on nuclear arms reductions, it's tended to have a beneficial impact for the broader relationship. But there still are going to be some friction points on relations. And I think one of the more difficult questions will remain this issue of how the United States engages with other post-Soviet states, such as Ukraine and Georgia, and finding that balance between engaging with those countries and also resetting relations with Russia is going to be a challenge. Now, just as a way of background, once the Soviet Union broke up in 1991, the U.S. government set out to build relations with all of the post-Soviet states. But several received priority. Russia, obviously, because of its size, large nuclear arsenal, its ability to impact other areas. But among the other countries that were sort of in the first tier of interest were Ukraine and Georgia. In the case of Ukraine, it was in part due to the fact that Ukraine had on its territory what was then the third largest strategic nuclear arsenal, which the Ukrainians gave up. But there was a sense that if you could help Ukraine succeed, that would be good not only for the region, but it would be more broadly stabilizing for the notion of a wider and more secure Europe. In the case of Georgia, early engagement, in part motivated by strategic concerns, is that Georgia was seen as a gateway into the Caspian area in Central Asia, but also a personal attachment to Eduard Shevardnadze, who had been the Soviet foreign minister at the end of the 1980s. Now, a part of this U.S. engagement with these two countries was also saying that they should build links with, integrate into Europe, European institutions, and Euro-Atlantic institutions. And that included support for developing their relations with the European Union and with NATO, including saying that if those countries wanted to, and at least in the case of Ukraine, it's still not clear whether the Ukrainians want this, but if they wanted to, and if they met the standards, they could one day be members of the alliance. That issue in particular came to a head last year over the question of membership action plans for Ukraine and Georgia, where the argument, and I mean, I would agree with this argument, that Ukraine and Georgia at the beginning of last year had made at least as much progress in terms of their democratic, economic, and military reforms as had countries such as Romania and Albania when they received membership action plans back in 1999. In any case, it didn't happen in part because a number of European allies were concerned that this would be simply too provocative a step for Russia. And indeed, last year was kind of the culmination of what you saw on the part of the Russians was expressing increasing anxiety about American engagement, but also the engagement of institutions such as the European Union, in particular NATO, with post-Soviet states on its border. Part of this is historical. I mean, in the case of Ukraine and Georgia, you have countries that were either part of Russia or part of the Russian Empire for hundreds of years. Part of it is Moscow's desire, which you've seen, I think, really in the last 8 years, is to regain great power status. This has been a real focus of Vladimir Putin. And great power status usually is accompanied by a sphere of influence. But in the last 4 or 5 years, you've seen on the part of the Russians a more assertive foreign policy, particularly in the post-Soviet space. And this came in particular, you saw it last year, with a very hard press or pushback by the Russians against the idea that Ukraine and Georgia would receive NATO membership action plans, including then-President Putin making the statement that Russia might actually target nuclear missiles on Ukraine. I also think that the conflict between Russia and Georgia over South Ossetia was not just about South Ossetia. It was also part of a broader message that the Russians wanted to send, the recipients being Ukraine and also countries in the West, about Russian concerns about what transpired in the post-Soviet space. Now, shortly after the conflict with Georgia, Russian President Medvedev gave a talk where he talked about 5 principles underlying Russian foreign policy. And one was this idea of a sphere of privileged interest, a sphere of influence on the post-Soviet space, which, among other things, seemed to be a red line saying Russia did not want to see Western institutions cross over into that area. Now, the Obama administration, while it talks about wanting to reset relations, and I think there really is a focus there of trying to get the U.S.-Russia relationship onto a more positive level, has also made clear it does not acknowledge the idea of a Russian sphere of influence in the post-Soviet space. And also, and I think it's quite proper in this, it supports the rights of countries as sovereign states to choose their own foreign policy course. So here's going to be a challenge for the U.S., which is, on the one hand, the U.S. will, I believe, continue to want to pursue a very robust relationship on a bilateral level with both Ukraine and Georgia. We'll also want to keep open their possible integration into institutions such as NATO. And on the other hand, how do you reconcile that with the desire also to have a more positive relationship with Russia when Russian policy is dead set against the idea of any integration by Ukraine and Georgia into the alliance? Now, it's not going to be easy working this out. On the one hand, I think it is important that Washington acknowledge and respect the fact that Russia does have legitimate security interests. But we have to be careful on this. It would be a mistake to let Moscow dictate that anything of concern of it, whether it's NATO enlargement or missile defense or even a declaration between the European Union and Ukraine on gas transit, is somehow an existential threat to Russia that has to be acknowledged as on a higher plane as opposed to other American interests and concerns. So in this context, let me offer a few policy recommendations. First, I think it is unwise for the West to accept the notion that there is a Russian sphere of influence. If Russia came to conclude that the pressure tactics of the last 3 or 4 years had succeeded in achieving that, that would not be an easier Russia with which the West could deal in the future. So it does argue that the United States should be continuing to pursue robust relations with both Ukraine and Georgia, and also to continue to support an active relationship between those two countries and NATO. Now, in addition to bilateral relations with the two countries, and I think in the case of Ukraine, this includes a regularized high-level dialogue, which we haven't had for 6 or 7 years. We probably should be helping them in terms of tackling their economic situation, offering some advice on energy security reform, and first and foremost, trying to persuade them to get the president and the prime minister, who have been at virtual war now for 10 months, to begin to work in a more coherent manner. In the case of Georgia, it's going to be assisting recovery after the conflict last August. Probably a bit more emphasis on democracy, because the democracy situation in Georgia is not as good as it should be. And hopefully it will entail a policy that focuses on U.S.-Georgian relations and does not have the personal element that it had in the last 4 years, where it seemed to be more about Saakashvili. We should also, I think, in the United States, be supporting the idea that NATO will have robust relations with these countries. The idea of a membership action plan seems to have fallen to the side for now. NATO foreign ministers in December said that NATO-Ukraine and NATO-Georgia relations will be developed on the basis of an annual national program. Now, the open secret here is you can take the content of the membership action plan and call it an annual national program. And the Russians don't seem to mind so much the content. It's just the name. So there may be a way to develop those relations without some of the tension of the past. Now, looking at Russia, we should also be working to develop a broad, robust relation with Russia. This includes START. It includes maybe missile defense. And if you look at the joint statement from London, it really did outline a very broad agenda. We should also be looking at ways that we can change NATO-Russia relations. Now, and in part, this means finding areas for cooperation. Afghanistan, counter-piracy, missile defense. And it also means working to try to reshape how NATO is seen by the Russians. Unfortunately, I think much of the Russian elite now looks at NATO and thinks about NATO of 20 to 25 years ago. What we want to do is find ways to engage Russia so that Russia increasingly sees NATO as a security partner. And when you look at things that NATO is doing today, operations in Afghanistan, peacekeeping in the Balkans, those are operations which are, in fact, in Russia's interest. So we've got to work to begin to reshape Russia's attitude here while recognizing that's going to be a very long and difficult struggle. And I guess my final point here is, my hope is that as we can begin to change and build a more robust, more positive U.S.-Russia relationship, and perhaps shape a more NATO, more positive NATO-Russia relationship, it's a different context in which differences between Washington over and Moscow over questions like Ukraine and Georgia will be less sharp and more manageable. And that may be the key to sort of having our cake and eating it too, in the sense that we can continue to go forward with Ukraine and Georgia while also resetting relations with the Russians. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve, and thank you. And now let's turn to our third speaker, Jim Goldgeier.
Great. Thank you, Jan. Thank you all. It's a great pleasure to be here. And knowing that my two colleagues would cover all the main issues in the relationship with Russia, I thought that I might step back and look a little more broadly at NATO as the NATO leaders are gathered for the 60th anniversary summit. The president was in France and Germany today as part of the NATO 60th anniversary celebration that will continue into tomorrow. And Russia certainly is one of the main items on the agenda of this summit, but there are others as well. At the top of the agenda is an issue that was discussed in the last panel, and that is Afghanistan, the war in Afghanistan, the strategy for the war in Afghanistan, the commitments by the different NATO members, how they will deal as NATO members with that war in Afghanistan. Also, NATO, while it has tried to find this fancy way out of the problem that it had with the Russians over Ukraine and Georgia, it is still enlarging and welcomes two new members at this anniversary summit, Albania and Croatia. France is rejoining the integrated NATO military command that it left in 1966, and this is, I think, a big step for both France, for NATO, for France's relations with the United States, the EU's relations with NATO, and I'll say a few words more about that in a moment, because I do think that that's, for me, it's been one of the most interesting things to watch in the last few days, is the relationship between President Obama and President Sarkozy, and I think what it signifies in changes in that the U.S.-France relationship. And one of the things that NATO members will be doing at this summit is launching what they call the process for a new strategic concept. NATO has these strategic concepts that are designed to guide the alliance and describe what the purposes are of the alliance and how the alliance looks at what its role is in the world. The last time this was done, it was in 1999, so that was a very different world, 1999. And they'll launch this process at this summit in Strasbourg and Kiel, and with the idea of having a strategic concept done by the summit in 2010. So let me just say, on Afghanistan, because it ties so closely to the strategic concept, Afghanistan is the major issue for NATO. It's the major challenge for NATO. You heard from Mike O'Hanlon all the challenges involved within Afghanistan, but it has also been a challenge for the alliance as an alliance, because you have developing a problem that Secretary Gates described back in February when he was in Europe, and that is what he called the problem of a two-tiered alliance of those willing to fight and those who are not willing to fight. And this is not a healthy situation for a military alliance. We have only a handful of members who are willing to engage with the United States in the actual fighting in Afghanistan. The other NATO countries are involved, but in very different ways. And some of these are in terms of civilian reconstruction and so on. Some of these are very important. But it does mean that certain countries are engaged in the fighting and thus bearing a heavier burden. And that was something that the Obama administration knew going into this summit that they were not going to be able to change, although it's a big topic of conversation. And we have seen in recent weeks what I call the re-Americanization of this war in Afghanistan. The president's announcement of 21,000 more troops, 17,000 combat, 4,000 trainers, and also the administration has let it be known that the president will decide later this year whether or not America will send an additional 10,000 troops, which would take the American total in Afghanistan to 70,000. Now, this is part of the larger issue of the strategic concept. What NATO will try to do, and this is related to the relationship with Russia, is to define what the purpose of this organization is in 2010 and beyond. It is a very different organization, geared toward very different kinds of threats than it was during the Cold War or even during the 1990s. It is engaged in this conflict far from home. As you may know, the core of NATO is this Article 5, which says that an attack on one will be considered an attack on all. It's the collective defense provision of NATO. Many members, many of the newer members, those in Eastern Europe, would like to see the alliance recommit itself to that Article 5, particularly in the wake of the Russian-Georgian War. And so this still remains very important for a number of members. But we live in a world in which threats don't emanate from right in your region. They are global in nature. And so how will NATO define itself as an organization that already is acting globally? And what part of that will be part of the NATO strategic concept? Because as NATO envisions itself as an actor acting in other parts of the world beyond Europe, then it inevitably raises concerns from other major countries out there, such as Russia and China, and that has to be thought through. And interestingly, the president, in his press conference today, was asked about this question, about NATO defining itself, and said that if NATO is everything, it is nothing. So I suppose we'll hear more about that later. On relations with Russia, I just want to underscore something that Steve said, because we have had these fora for NATO-Russian relations, the Permanent Joint Council that was established in 1997, and then it was replaced in the George W. Bush years by this NATO-Russia Council. And it has been very difficult to generate real concrete NATO-Russian cooperation. And I would just mention in that regard, since one of the co-chairs of this event here is former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, former Secretary Perry used to talk about, in the mid-90s, with respect to the establishment of the implementation force in Bosnia that was put into place after the Dayton Accords ended the war, and he was a big proponent of bringing Russia into those, into that implementation force, and argued that if we can get the practice right, the theory will follow. And I think, you know, as Steve was mentioning, the, you know, sort of action counter-piracy or counter-terrorism, there are real joint exercises that and actions that one can take with the Russians, and I would hope that that would go forward. NATO also needs to think about its relations with other institutions, other international actors, other major countries, its relationship with the United Nations, its relationship with the European Union, which really has not developed very effectively, and hopefully with France's return to the Integrated Military Command, this will signal in part an effort to rejuvenate NATO-EU relations, but also something that started in 2006, NATO's relations with other major democracies elsewhere in the world, particularly in Asia, Japan, South Korea, Australia, and New Zealand. There are many who would like to see these partnerships develop, but of course, as you think about that, then again, you get into the question of needing to be sensitive to the concerns of non-democracies such as Russia and China. And finally, I do want to come back to this issue of France. I've been fascinated to watch the body language and the discussions that have come out between the President of the United States and the President of France. And I think, in fact, you know, we talk about the reset of relations with Russia. I think we're seeing a reset of relations with France. The enthusiasm that President Sarkozy is showing for his American counterpart, I think in part he hopes some of that popularity will rub off on him. Everybody wants to get as close as they can to President Obama. But I do think it's more than that. It is a redefinition of interest, and I think it's worth mentioning that just in terms of thinking about the problems we've had in U.S.-Russian relations, where it's been hard to think about redefining interests. France used to define its interests and believe that it would be stronger if it would be more opposed to the United States. And President Sarkozy seems to believe that if he works closely with the United States, that will be more beneficial to France. One could say it's almost a British approach to the relationship, and I think that this is very important. But there's also still, for those the two presidents, I think a need to overcome the skepticism in Europe and about the United States, what it's for, and especially this war in Afghanistan. I was very struck by President Obama's comments today. He had a town hall meeting. There were mainly students from France and Germany there. And he went out of his way to try to say, as he needs to and as European leaders need to, that this war in Afghanistan is one that we all must contribute an effort toward to try to see it to some kind of successful conclusion, however we define success, because many Europeans in France and elsewhere have looked at Afghanistan as part of what they consider to be the misguided policies of George W. Bush. They lump it together with the war in Iraq. They have not seen that Europe should be more heavily involved in this. And President Obama really went out of his way to say, as he said today in this town hall, he said, just because Barack Hussein Obama is now President of the United States, that does not make the problem of al-Qaeda and Afghanistan go away. That's, I think, where a lot of the hard work will come in the effort to rebuild U.S.-European relations, which there's a great opportunity because of the tremendous popularity of the American president throughout Europe as well as in the rest of the world. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jim. And thank you to our three speakers for excellent remarks. And we have, as you might imagine, a whole pile of questions which are coming our way. The first set of questions that we received tie in to missile defense, and not only in terms of its own characteristics, but in terms of how a discussion on missile defense might impact the relationship between Russia and the U.S. So let's start with Pavel and then go on to maybe Steve in asking the question. First, Pavel, there was a question about, given all these technical problems with missile defense, you know, and how unproven all of this is, why are we bothering with this in Eastern Europe or Azerbaijan collaboratively or anywhere?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, the answer is that basically there is a certain, again, if you look at the history of kind of missile defense, there is a certain appeal that you could have this magic wand and solve the problem, and old missiles will just go away. And then what happened in the past was the reality would just catch on, and people would realize that no, this is not a magic wand, and there is a, just adding to the problem. This is how the ABM treaty came along in 1972. This is how this vision of Star Wars, the Strategic Defense Initiative, how that eventually collapsed. What's happening today is that the missile defense that the United States is building exists only because there is no threat that that system should is supposed to counter. Basically, as soon as those countries, I hope they won't, but if Iran's or North Korea's of the world are really serious about actually acquiring missiles that could threaten the United States, as soon as that happens, then people would quickly realize that missile defense is not an option at all, but that hasn't happened yet. So I think that that people are just throwing all this money at the issue. So that's a brief summary. And again, the idea then another idea was that somehow missile defense would dissuade again North Koreans and Iran's from building missiles. And as you can see, this is not happening because North Korea is preparing to test its missiles. It hasn't given up. As for the cooperation on whether it's in Azerbaijan or elsewhere, I think there is a value in cooperation itself. The process is as important as the result, and I think there is a good idea in the Russian proposal, and that this is something that is not directly kind of linked to missile defense, and the idea is to use Russian radar, maybe other facilities, to monitor missile tests in the region and to monitor developments in that area. And that you could do, and once you start that process, you could take it and actually start monitoring satellites and start this work together. And I think that's the kind of foundation that is not related to missile defense itself.
Well, thank you, Pavel. And then, Steve, several questions were directed to the concern that the Kremlin has expressed about missile defense and whether, if we are going to suspend this or even consider not doing it at all, whether this couldn't be used to get a whole lot more Russian cooperation in preventing the nuclear weapons capability in Iran. And one questioner said, well, you know, not only, you know, preventing it, but also much expanded intelligence cooperation vis-a-vis the Iranian program. I mean, to what extent can all of this be used as effective leverage vis-a-vis the Iran nuclear problem?
Okay. Well, I guess I'd make three points. First, I think Pavel's exactly right. I mean, the planned missile defense system in Poland and the Czech Republic really has no serious capability against Russian strategic systems. However, the Russians look at the timeline and say the Americans are now investing or plan to invest a significant amount of money to build a system for a missile that the Iranians have not yet produced and probably won't produce for another 8 to 10 years. Russians sometimes are conspiratorial, and they think, well, this must be about us somehow. There is, I think, that concern, even though if it may not be well-based, that we have to deal with. The second point was, from the Russian perspective, the Bush administration commitment to deploying 10 interceptor missiles in Poland and a radar in the Czech Republic was unshakable. I mean, I think the Russians concluded that there was nothing that they could suggest, propose, that would alter the fundamental plan to deploy that system in Central Europe. So, for example, when President Putin said, we'll make our radar in Azerbaijan available, maybe even some radars in southern Russia, Bush administration's response was, fine, we'll tack that onto the system we're building in Poland and the Czech Republic. And part of this was, I think, the Bush administration, one of the things that they came in on was talking about missile defense, and I think that was really a hardcore principle for them. The third point, though, is I think the Obama administration brings a very different perspective, which is that missile defense may have a role to play, but you ought to take a look at it in light of a number of factors. And I was struck by, during the campaign, the position of the Obama campaign was, we support missile defense provided it's workable. When the vice president was in Munich in February, he said, we support missile defense provided it's workable and cost-effective. And then a week later, when Undersecretary of State Bill Burns was in Moscow, he said, we support missile defense provided it's workable, cost-effective, and appropriate to the threat. I'm not quite sure how that's being read in Moscow, but that's a pretty different signal than what they got from the Bush administration. And although there was some discussion in the newspapers, what was in the president's letter? I mean, I think what the president said, I don't think the president said, if you do X, we'll do Y on missile defense. But he made what strikes me as a perfectly logical statement, which is, if the Iranians choose not to pursue a nuclear weapons program, or if the Iranians don't go forward with this long-range ballistic missile, it affects our perception of a need for missile defense in Central Europe. I mean, that's not a quid pro quo, that's a statement of logic. I mean, if the Iranians were to back down on those two programs of concern, in the current budget environment, it's awfully hard to understand why we would spend a couple billion dollars building a system that would then have no threat to deal with. So I think what you've seen, and I think the message has been received in Russia, and the way the Russians seem to be talking about it is, they understand here that they're is not the commitment, the ironclad commitment of the Bush administration. There is a willingness here to talk, listen, and perhaps find some middle ground. And so already you've seen the language that the Russians use with regards to missile defense moderated. And I'm not sure this is going to be subject to an early agreement, but it seems to me that this is an area that's open to discussion. And here, in fact, the timelines may well work in our favor, because the Bush administration plan was to have the missile defense system operational in either 2012 or 2013. Whereas most projections of when the Iranians would have a long-range missile of concern were more in the 2015, 2016, and out time frame. So there's a couple of years to play with, and we may not have to go forward on this as urgently as it was done in the previous administration.
Well, thank you, Stephen. Could I push you a little bit more on what we can get the Russians to do if indeed there is a positive resolution of their concerns on missile defense vis-a-vis Iran?
Right. Yeah. This is one where I think it's hard to draw a specific quid pro quo, and I also think we have to be realistic. If we can begin to change the relationship between Washington and Moscow, one of our goals should be is to get the Russians to be more helpful on Iran, which it would, in the first order, be having the Russians being prepared to at least threaten more severe sanctions if the Iranians don't back down on their nuclear program or on their missile program. Now, having said that, I think it's we need to also be realistic in Washington about how much we can get the Russians to go down that path. And there's a couple reasons here. First of all, from the Russian perspective, there's a range of interests they have in Iran, geopolitical, economic, energy, it's an arms market. And it really is their only geopolitical entry into the Persian Gulf. So they're going to be reluctant to do damage to that relationship. We just have to understand that. The other problem is, I think the Russians just see the Iranian nuclear problem with less urgency than we do. First of all, their timeline for when Iran can actually have a nuclear weapon is longer than ours. And part of that may be self-delusional. It's easier to justify continuing a nuclear reactor program with Iran if you say, well, they couldn't get the bomb for a longer period of time. But I think even if, and I want to be clear, Moscow does not want to see a nuclear-armed Iran. But if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, it's not the nightmare scenario for them that it is for us. It's probably more like Pakistan when it tested in 1998. From the perspective of American security, it was a bad thing, but we figured we could work with it. We could deal with it. And so I think that difference in interest in Iran, but also that difference in sense of urgency is going to be such that the Russians will never be quite as helpful as we'd like to be, although hopefully they'll be more helpful than they've been in the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. Thank you. And Pavel, you had a quick comment as well.
Just to add a bit, I think I agree with Stephen that there is a we should really be careful about what the United States could expect from Russia in regard to the Iran. It's not like there was a decision made in the Kremlin that we do this on Iran and we don't do that. It's a much more complex process. As you can imagine, there are people in Russia who are very much interested in keeping that confrontation going, who are interested in, for example, selling arms to Iran. There are really some kind of a geopolitical considerations. So it's a complex process. So the only way to influence that and to have Russia as an ally in this process is to create a base of support for cooperation with the United States, as opposed to a confrontation with the United States. And that, I think, again, expanding kind of institutes of cooperation, that's the way to go.
Thank you. And Jim, there were a couple of questions on the issue of NATO expansion and the concern that Russia has about that. And again, kind of in the context of if we were not to press all that hard on NATO expansion, could that be used as a basis for getting more Russian cooperation on issues of concern to us?
Well, I think that it's important to understand the origins of NATO expansion in terms of the nature of the alliance itself. The alliance was formed with a treaty in 1949, and Article 10 says that the alliance is open to any European country that can, you know, conform to the principles of the alliance and contribute to the alliance's security. And so in the post-Cold War period, we have seen countries in waves develop democracy, market economies, whatever we mean by that term today, respect for human rights, and so on, that would allow them to, and a willingness to contribute to the security of the members of the alliance that would allow them to join the alliance. And NATO can't really be in the business of saying, well, we've taken all the ones we can take in, and the ones who aren't yet in, well, too bad for them. They're just too close to Russia. Because NATO is drawing a new line in Europe. So it really can't do that, I think, to maintain the integrity of the alliance. But what it can do, as Steve was mentioning, it really has already put the issue of Ukraine and Georgia off to the side for the moment. And in fact, if we compare this year's NATO summit with last year's NATO summit, both missile defense and enlargement are much, much less urgent issues and causing much less problems, fewer problems with the Russians than they did a year ago at the NATO summit in Bucharest in the run-up to that summit within the alliance and between the alliance and Russia. And because of this, we took the term out, membership action plan, and NATO will go forward. The issue was always people heard membership action plan and thought, oh, these countries are becoming members of NATO. I mean, neither Ukraine nor Georgia will be a member of NATO for, I don't know, 15 years, 20 years. I mean, it's so far down the road. The goal is to get them in a process by which they do the things that are necessary to develop internally the way NATO countries need to develop in order to be considered for membership, if that's the choice that those countries would want to make. And so I think we've found found a solution to the problem that can carry us forward for some time, which is to just work with them with these commissions and chart their annual progress and in the meantime worry about other things.
All right, let me try to push you a little bit more on that question, as I did earlier with Steve, vis-a-vis Russian behavior. If indeed there is a longer time period
for the any membership issue for Ukraine and Georgia, understanding the point that you made about how we cannot draw a new line here. Well, that addresses a really strongly expressed set of Russian concerns, and shouldn't we be expecting more Russian cooperation on Ukraine and Georgia issues from our standpoint if we are in fact addressing their concerns? Shouldn't we be asking them to be more restrained and more cooperative vis-a-vis those two countries if we're not pushing the membership point as hard ourselves?
Well, I think particularly what I would argue in terms of restraint, we do have in Europe the members of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, of which Russia is one, as are we. This was the product, as it has evolved from the 1975 Helsinki Final Act, whose had a number of different elements to it, one of which was that borders in Europe would only be changed peacefully. And the countries, members of the OSCE, are supposedly committed to this. So, for example, you could change borders peacefully, as the Czech and Slovak governments decided that they would dissolve Czechoslovakia and have two independent countries. They mutually agreed on that. That's perfectly acceptable within the norms of the Helsinki process. And my one of the concerns, many concerns I had about last summer's behavior, is that this is not a principle that is as robustly upheld as it should be, and I think also points to a problem for NATO, and that is that there were many in the West who watched that war unfold and said, good thing Georgia's not a member of NATO, because otherwise the United States and its European allies would actually have to come to its defense. And it's certainly an understandable reaction. But that means then that the norm, the Helsinki norm, does that NATO, you know, NATO is willing to uphold it for its own members, but it's not going to be willing to uphold it for other countries in Europe. I think that's a very dangerous situation, and I think that we really need to push hard to get a recommitment to those principles. And in fact, I've argued that, and we didn't hear anything much about this, at least that I noticed from this summit between the two presidents. Last year, President Medvedev proposed that there be a new European, pan-European security architecture because of Russian feelings that the institutions we have aren't addressing all of their needs. And I think that if we were to do something like that, I think that one of the issues we should put on the agenda is a recommitment to this norm.
Okay. And let me turn and ask Steve perhaps to comment on this. And there's another question, too, you might take on board as you're commenting, which is the overall picture is one of increasing Russian pressure on Ukraine, increasing Russian pressure on Georgia. And here we are moving toward, at least a delay in dealing with the accession issues, the NATO accession issues for Ukraine and Georgia. And what more can we do to press the Russians? What more can we do to reinforce the Ukrainians? What more can we do to deal with the accession problem in view of the positive evolution in the Western side?
To get back to the first question, I mean, I don't think it would be wise or perhaps even proper for the United States to begin to sort of talk to the Russians and say, let's cut a deal. You know, we'll back off on Ukraine and Georgia and NATO in return for X. I mean, that's sort of, I think, it's a bit unseemly as foreign policy, but I think it's also strategically unwise for the United States. Mm-hmm. And it would recall, I think, too many allusions back to Yalta.
Right.
Now, we do, I think, have this problem, though, which is there is a Russia there that has, over the last 3 or 4 years, been clearly much more assertive. In the case of South Ossetia and Georgia, going way over the line in terms of how it pressed its requirements. I will say on the Georgia conflict, because I think sometimes it's been lost in the U.S. government narrative. There was certainly a lot of provocation by the Russians to Georgia over the course of the summer last year. But on August 7, the Georgian president made a decision to send his military into South Ossetia in a way that is very difficult to understand. I think if you ask pretty much anyone to take a look at it and say, what would the Russian response would be, the Russian response would have been a major military response. Now, had Saakashvili not made that decision, I don't think there would have been a war. Now, there still would have been a lot of tension, and there would have been the potential for a war at some other point. But that decision by Saakashvili triggered this. So the Russians are they're not blameless in this. They certainly were prepared for the war. They were ready to go. They were very fast to respond. And there were probably a lot of people in Moscow who were grateful for the pretext. But Saakashvili still gave them the pretext. In terms of what we can do, because I think our levers are thin, it does, though, suggest going and trying now to see if we can build out a thicker U.S.-Russia relationship. There's no evidence that last summer when the Russians were thinking through what they would do in Georgia that anybody said, wait, we ought not to do this because it will harm the American-Russian relationship. Mm-hmm. And that was because that relationship had fallen to such a low point that the Russians simply didn't care. Well, one of our goals in working on things like START and missile defense and expanding commercial cooperation, even if we still differ on places like Ukraine and Georgia, is to begin to build a thick relationship that people in Moscow will care about. So that there is a crisis between Russia and Georgia, between Russia and Ukraine, and Russians are thinking, well, maybe we should do X. We want to have people around the table saying to Medvedev and Putin, well, wait a minute. If you do this, it could undercut equities we have with the Americans. And we want to have a relationship that, in fact, actually has people saying, we care about this, and it's a restraining influence.
Okay, thank you. Let's turn a little bit beyond the Russia, Ukraine, Georgia set of issues to the broader area of the former Soviet space. And talk, there was a question about Central Asia, saying, look, we're always talking about the Caucasus, we're talking about Ukraine. What about the countries of Central Asia? Aren't they a major area of interest now, both in terms of the position of Kazakhstan? Or another part of the question was, what about the connection with, of course, going down south to Turkmenistan and Afghanistan? I mean, isn't this an area which needs a lot more attention? Aren't we giving it short shrift so far? To Steve, perhaps, and then the other two, if you'd like to comment on Central Asia.
No, I think certainly there has been U.S. interest in Central Asia, and it's particularly in the aftermath of 9/11 when we actually needed to have military facilities in Central Asia in order to be able to conduct military operations against the Taliban and al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. There's also, going back to the 1990s, been a lot of interest in finding ways to bring the energy resources of the Caspian area in Central Asia to global markets. And I think, Jan, you were very closely involved in that when you were in the government. So there are those interests. I mean, I think Central Asia gets less attention for a couple of reasons. Well, maybe three reasons. First of all, it's farther away from Europe. When you talk to Europeans about NATO, I mean, I think some people can say, okay, maybe someday if we can figure out to work out the Russia problem, I can see Ukraine in NATO. Nobody in Europe sees Kazakhstan in NATO. So you don't have that institutional draw, which you do have with Ukraine and Georgia. So that's one reason. A second reason is that the democracy issues are more difficult in Central Asia. And you're dealing with the Stans where you really have not seen much progress at all in terms of building any of the institutions of a modern democracy. Whereas in a place like Ukraine, and you can say that Ukrainians have not taken advantage of what they did after the Orange Revolution, but Ukraine is a country where there's basically an open, vibrant democracy. It's certainly flawed. It's very, very messy. It doesn't produce efficient government. But there's a certain confidence there that the Ukrainian people in 6 or 8 months are going to have a chance to go and fully decide their next president of the polls, which you can't say about Central Asia. So I think that's an area. And even Georgia. I mean, I think Georgia is not quite as far along as Ukraine on democracy, but there still is. There are institutions there that make Georgia a more attractive place than, say, Central Asia. Mm-hmm. And then the other part, I think, is just in terms of strategic reach. You have a fairly concerted effort by the Russians, in this case working in a tactical alliance with the Chinese, to minimize American and Western influence in Central Asia. And they have tools and resources that outmatch ours, so it makes us more difficult to operate in that space.
Thank you. Do Pavel or Jim, any comment on that? All right, well, then let's go on to a topic that Steve referred to, which is energy. A couple of questions, as you might imagine, on energy issues. One having to do with how can the Europeans increase their own energy security in the face of their dependence on Russia? What can we do to help them do that? And another very interesting question, which is now in a lower oil price environment, what is the impact of that, do you think, on Russian policy and Russian goals? And I wonder whether, Jim, do you want to start talking about that, and then we can go back through the panel here to see whether any other comments?
Sure. Well, I do think what we've seen in recent years with Russian foreign policy generally most of which we've already talked about, and that is an effort to establish firm control over the bulk of the post-Soviet space and really establish Russia as the major, as the regional hegemon there. We've also seen the effort to control the supply of oil and really not allow for alternative ways of getting that oil out to the West. I mean, the Russians are very keen on ensuring their control. But I do think it's worth noting with respect to the Russian relationship with Europe, and certainly there's a great variation in terms of countries that are almost completely dependent, for example, on natural gas from Russia versus countries that have a little more room to maneuver. That's a very difficult thing to change. I mean, for those countries that are so heavily dependent on Russia, you don't change that your source of supply that quickly. But it is worth noting that it is an interdependent relationship. I mean, Russia does need to sell this energy to the Europeans, just in terms of the way that the pipelines are located and structured, and the other opportunities for Russia, also the decreasing energy production because of lack of Russian investment in the energy sector. They should have made more of an investment in their infrastructure. They are, to some extent, dependent on Europe as well, so we shouldn't forget that, because they do need the money in order to continue to foster the social stability that they've enjoyed since the crash of 1998.
Okay, great. And Steve, as you address these two questions, both European dependence and the question of impact on Russian behavior of low oil prices, it might be worth also addressing the European-Ukraine-Russian gas conundrum and making a few remarks about where that is and where that's going.
Okay, well, just on the Russia question, I mean, if you talk about a resurgent Russia, Russia looks a lot less resurgent when oil is priced at $45 a barrel than it was at $140 a barrel. So I think this has an impact. I'm not quite sure yet that I'm smart enough to figure out how this all plays out, because it gets not only into the price of energy, but through this very real economic crisis that Russia is going through now, which they've spent $220 billion of their reserves trying to maintain the ruble, and even then the ruble's lost about 30% of its value against the dollar over the last 5 months. They are still trying to figure out exactly how they get through this crisis. And it seems to me that there's one of two ways the Russians can respond. One is that they sort of draw in on themselves. They decide to maintain this image, which they've worked to create over the last 3 or 4 years, of the United States as the adversary. The economic crisis was the result of the Americans. And they use this enemy image really to sort of divert attention from very real problems at home. And this would be a response that Russia has done in the past. The other approach, in which I'm hoping, and which I think we may be seeing, is that the Russians come to a conclusion that a calmer international context, including better relations with Washington, will make it easier for them to address those domestic problems. And that's the way they're playing. Certainly the signals of the last month or so suggest that's the way they're going, but I'm still not yet sure that we know for sure. So a lot of it will depend on the concrete engagement we've seen between Washington and Moscow the next several months, which way Washington or the Russians have decided to play. Now, on the question of Ukraine, I mean, this is Jim was exactly right when he talks about this mutual interdependency between Russia, which has the energy that Europe needs, but Russia also needs the money that it gets from selling that energy. So any decision to cut off the energy flows is not an easy one. The complication that Ukraine poses is about 80% of the gas that Russia ships to Europe goes through Ukraine. And there's this parallel dependent mutual dependency between Russia and Ukraine. Ukraine gets about 65% of its gas from Russia. And the Russians have in the past used that energy as a tool. The Ukrainians then respond with the leverage that they have, which is they can turn off the pipeline and cut the flow to Europe. So you've got this fairly complex situation where if you're in Europe, you worry not only about Russia's reliability as a seller of gas, but Ukraine's reliability as a transit state. You know, it's one of those things where if they could work it out, all three, it could be a triple win situation. But the politics seem to be such that's going to be a little bit more difficult. Now the good news is that as a result of this last gas war in January, there seems to have been some progress between Ukraine and Russia in putting their relationship in terms of how Russia sells gas to Ukraine on a more normal basis. They actually have a contract which people in the energy industry say is not an ideal contract, but it looks a lot more like contracts that Russia has with Western European countries. And so it's a little bit more predictable. Now, it doesn't eliminate the possibility for the Russians and the Ukrainians if they're determined to go back into another gas war. But it should make, if there's the appropriate will on both sides, it should make it an easier relationship to manage and perhaps give the Europeans a bit more confidence about this very complex arrangement continuing to be reliable in terms of getting the gas to Europe that Europe needs.
Very good. Thank you. Pavel, there was another question about Poland and the Czech Republic in the context of missile defense. I mean, here are two countries that went out of their way with the previous administration to commit to the missile defense system. And now they're finding themselves in a very awkward position of perhaps not having it come to their territory, and they were on a limb and were effectively sawing it off. What is your commentary on this, and how do we address the Polish and the Czech reaction, which, as I understand, is a little bit different, actually, between those two countries?
Well, it's another interesting part of this this whole story because if you look at the reasons, sort of the dynamic of the internal dynamic in Poland and to some extent in the Czech Republic, the Poles, they were actually, and I had a chance to talk to people in the foreign ministry and in the defense ministry there, they were fairly cynical about this whole enterprise. They were saying the only reason we are doing that, or the main reason we are doing that, we want U.S. presence on the Polish soil. And this goes back to the the Article 5 commitment. I was at a very interesting meeting at which the old Europe sort of asked the new Europe, what about the Article 5 commitment? We already made that commitment to you. And they basically...
You might just clarify Article 5. For
Article 5 is the NATO NATO provision that that the NATO as an alliance would come to the rescue if a country is attacked. And basically the Poles and the Czechs, they basically said, well, we don't quite trust that commitment. I mean, it wasn't said in that many words, but basically that was a clear sense in the air. And I think there are legitimate questions about the strengths of that commitment. So again, for Poland, that was definitely a way of bringing the United States closer and build a special relationship with the United States. Roughly the same dynamic was in the Czech Republic, although the Czechs were a bit more enthusiastic about this this system. But then again, they saw that as a way of building a special relationship with the United States. And again, there was that this whole story actually did create a bit of mistrust within NATO, because apparently the France and the British they didn't quite like the fact that the new Europe that they sort of made their agreement with the United States over the head of NATO. And this is, and again, just sort of to bring this point back again, this missile defense issue, we haven't seen anything yet, and probably I hope won't see anything, but it does create real problems and it does create real tensions. Those are, I think, are completely unnecessary.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And Jim, I'm sure you'd like to say a word or two about the Eastern European connection in the NATO and missile defense.
Well, I think it is. I think it is very awkward, and I would say, it's awkward in a number of dimensions, as Pavel just alluded to. When the United States first pursued this endeavor, rather than going through NATO, which is what they should have done.
Right.
They worked this bilaterally with the Polish government and the Czech government. And then after the fact, they tried to bring NATO on board. So last year at the NATO summit in Bucharest, they got an alliance commitment to support the missile defense. So now to not go through NATO in making decisions about the missile defense it puts us, in a sense, back where we were. I mean, we've there are many ways in which we have not handled this, and there are systems that defensive systems that Poland wants from the United States that I think are more important to Poland than the missile defense. I mean, they want the United States support for defensive systems, Patriot missiles, which in fact are not directed against Iran. And so that I think add some complications into the relationship. But there were a lot of mistakes that had been made previously in the way that the United States went about this. So I hope that as the United States tries to recalculate how it wants to conceive of these issues, that it does so in a way that's not only supportive of these governments, but also supportive of the alliance as a whole.
Very interesting comment. Well, we're coming toward the close, and I think there's time for another set of questions, and I'll ask each of the panelists to put in their 2 cents worth on it. And that is, what is your sense of where Russia is in terms of what one questioner called its muscular foreign policy? Is this something that you think will continue into the future? Will it be evidenced, for example, in the relations with the neighborhood, the former Soviet space? And in terms of the Western interest in giving the countries of the former Soviet Union more latitude to develop their own policies and their own relationships, what further can we do to push back against this muscularity in Russian policy? And do you see a change that's a function of maybe this leadership leading to the next leadership in Moscow, you know, over time, not just in the next year or two, but over 5, 10, 15 years? What is your sense of the nature of the Russian challenge in terms of where it is today and where it's going in the future? And that cuts in, of course, to what Steve was discussing in terms of the economic environment for Russian policy, not only oil prices, but the financial crisis and the longer-term impact of that. Does anybody want to take a crack? Yes, Jim, do you want to get started and then go through the panel? Yes.
Sure. And Steve put the question quite well, which was, you know, as Russia, especially with lower oil prices and economic crisis, does it try to build up a threat from the West for domestic purposes, or does it pursue a liberalization policy, pursue better relations with the West because it can't afford bad relations with the West? And we don't know the answer to that, but it's interesting to think historically, at least of the past 35 years, if you go back to the oil shock of 1973 and then forward with the big rise of oil prices in the 1970s, the Soviets had a very aggressive foreign policy. When oil prices collapsed in the 1980s, you then saw a very different Russian approach, and we got, for example, with Gorbachev, a very different Russian foreign policy going into the Yeltsin years. People forget, I mean, in 1998, when Yeltsin was dealing with various problems at home and his relationship with the United States, oil was $11 a barrel. And as oil prices went up, we saw Russia become more assertive once again. So I do think that there is something to be said for watching the correlation between the price of oil and the Russian energy situation, economic situation, and its effort to cultivate better relations, especially with the United States.
Another crack? 3 quick points. I do think that as long as Vladimir Putin is close to power, you're going to see a fairly muscular, robust Russian foreign policy. Second, it means that we're going to have to be prepared to push back at times. And the one thing I took from the discussion the last couple of days from what President Obama has said is it's been interesting, you know, while he's talked about resetting relations with Russia and cooperation with Russia, he's also made very clear that there are some issues, and there are a number of issues, missile defense, NATO enlargement, South Ossetia, where we differ with Russia. And so he's making clear that, you know, he can work with Russia on some issues while also maintaining the fact that on some questions we'll have to push back, and I think that's healthy. Mm-hmm. And then the last point is that over the longer term, if we can begin to develop this more positive U.S.-Russia relationship, if NATO and Russia can engage in a more positive way, a more creative way, so that the Russians would begin to see that, okay, we can work with NATO. NATO actually does things that are in our interest. Maybe that begins to change their attitude. But I don't want to, having underestimated how hard that was going to be back in the late 1990s, I don't want to underestimate again how hard that will be. That will be a long, difficult process.
Right. Thank you. Pavel?
Just very briefly, I think engagement would be a very brief and a core word in that. There is a lot of interest in Russia in toward working with the West and with the United States in particular. There are people, and Russians certainly see that they would benefit from the inflow of expertise, money, and everything. And they do see themselves as part of the larger kind of international community. They do want to be treated kind of as equals, and they are sometimes awkward partners and difficult partners, but still, I think again the history of the last several years, the last 8 years, shows that if you just drop the ball and if you don't pay attention to building the institutions of cooperation, you get the relationships going on the downhill.
Right. Thank you. Well, on behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California, I'd like to thank Pavel Pudvig, Jim Goldgeier, and Stephen Pfeiffer for wonderful remarks and very interesting discussion this afternoon. And thank you for all the great questions. I got through some, but not all of them here. If you'd like to read more on this topic, I hope you'll visit the book table in the Italian room throughout the conference. You'll find there Gems America Between the Wars. We'll now take a 15-minute break and then reconvene at 4 o'clock in the Grand Ballroom for a roundtable panel discussion with Jim and Fabian Hara, Dan Reicher, Dan Rosen, and World Affairs Council President Jane Wales on the topic, The First 70 Days, Has the Obama Administration Got It Right? So thanks again to our speakers, and we'll see you at 4 o'clock in the Grand Hall.